This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
I'm going to do a quick introduction of all of our panelists and then just kind of dive right in. So starting with Kevin here on the end, Kevin Adler is the founder and CEO of Miracle Messages, a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping people experiencing homelessness rebuild their social support systems and financial security. Kevin is currently completing his MPA from the Goldman School of Public Policy, so good company up here. And he recently published the book, When We Walk By, Forgotten Humanity, Broken Systems, and Their Role We Can Each Play in Ending Homelessness in America. Next to Kevin is Robin Rose Hamer. She is the vice president at Capital Impact and a lived expertise advisory board representative from the UCSF Benioff Homelessness and Housing Initiative. She focused on economic justice, diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. And Robin's continued passion is helping people obtain the education and skills they need to pursue their goals. Next to Robin is Ryan Finnegan, who is an associate research director for the Turner Center for Housing Innovation, leading the center's research on homelessness and housing affordability. His research over the past several years has really focused on homelessness services throughout California. So we'll be asking him a lot on to dig in there. And then next to Ryan is Kyriel Noon, who is the CEO of Hamilton Families in the city. He's the leading nonprofit service provider of families experiencing homelessness in the San Francisco Bay Area. He has over 20 years of deep nonprofit experience in the city and around the Bay Area, serving at Juma Ventures, Youth and Family Enrichment Services, Stop AIDS Project, San Francisco AIDS Foundation, and GLIDE before joining Hamilton. So all to say on stage tonight, we have a lot of deep and varied expertise on the challenges and solutions to homelessness. So I want to just get right into it. So starting with Ryan, before we dig into some of the solutions, which is going to be a big part of this conversation, because I think we hear a lot about the challenges, and we really want to start to focus on what is actually working and where do we just need to do more on those things. So I'm going to be asking the panelists a lot about sort of where they're seeing signs for hope and signs that solutions are working. But before we dig into to those things with your counterparts, Ryan, I'm hoping you can provide the audience with some context sort of from your research efforts from the Turner Center. We generally understand that homelessness has increased in recent years and has certainly become more visible. We also know that people are becoming homeless at a faster rate than we are able to hope that folks back into homelessness. In fact, in many places across the Bay Area and the state, we're seeing for every one family that is becoming rehoused after being homeless, is three or four are becoming homeless at that same time. So we're seeing a real challenge in sort of the inflow. We're also hearing a lot of assumptions, right, about why this crisis is getting worse. Is it substance use? Is it affordable housing? Is it sort of folks coming in because the Bay Area has such amazing homeless services? There's a lot of assumptions. These are all myths y'all have heard, so don't. But really digging in on sort of like what are you seeing are the actual things that are causing folks to become homeless and why is this crisis where it's at? So we'd love to just sort of level set if you don't mind.
Absolutely. I spent a lot of time thinking about this question, as you know, and I'm happy to share my two cents. Yeah. And I think it is a really challenging question for folks to think through for many reasons. Yeah. I think one of them is that what people see on the street or around them is not the full picture of what pushes people into homelessness or how people experience it or what works to help people move out of it. And I like to think that people are little social scientists walking around and what they see are their data, but their data are incomplete. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's one of the big challenges for people to think through it. The other way in which it's a really tricky question for a lot of folks is that the reason that any one person might get pushed into homelessness can be really complicated. It can be layered with many things, and it can be hard to go back in time and trace what was the point where this was what caused this trajectory, or this is where things really started to get shaky. But it's a very different way of thinking about homelessness to imagine why is it that there's so much homelessness in California and there is not as much homelessness in other places. And when we think about homelessness from that bird's eye view, it becomes a little bit clearer to think through what are the factors that overlap and push people into homelessness in California. And so we think about mental health crises, we think about substance use issues, in part because people see that on the street. But when we look at the data and we look at rates of homelessness, West Virginia has had entrenched poverty for generations. West Virginia has one of the highest rates of opioid addiction in the country. Mm-hmm. West Virginia does not have the same rate of homelessness that California does. Mm-hmm. And it's because housing is relatively cheaper and more abundant in West Virginia than it is in California. When housing is scarce and when housing is expensive, it's just easier to get pushed off the edge and into homelessness or into that trajectory of staying with friends, staying with family, and then eventually running out of people to stay with. And it's that kind of big picture context around this housing crisis that California has been in for decades and accumulating for decades that makes all of the individual, complicated, messy parts of our lives push us into homelessness more easily here than it would somewhere else. And that same kind of perspective is helpful for thinking through why do we see such stark racial and ethnic disparities and inequalities in homelessness? When systemic racism pervades housing markets, education, criminal justice systems, policing, job opportunities, it's easy to see why it is so, there are so many more factors pushing people of color into homelessness in California, and it's happening at a community level. So it's not just that one person is encountering these kinds of systemic inequalities, but families, communities are encountering them all together, which gives people fewer resources to turn to within their community to avoid homelessness. And then on kind of trying to think about why homelessness is so much harder to solve or so challenging to move out of or keep short, I think there's a couple big factors. One is that we're investing in housing and homelessness services now, but that takes time. Housing takes time to build, programs take time to stand up and expand. And we have pushed those efforts to a bigger scale later than the homelessness crisis really began to take off in California. And as the crisis has been sustained, there's a level of trauma and hardship that accumulates for people experiencing homelessness, where a simple housing voucher now isn't going to be enough for somebody who's experienced sustained homelessness for several years in a way where if they had gotten that intervention sooner, that might have been everything that they needed. And so I think that combination of our entrenched housing crisis and then its sustained nature and how long it takes to really right that oil tanker is a big part of why we see what we see in California in a way that we don't see it elsewhere.
Yeah, and I'm so grateful that you point out sort of the number of, like the decisions we made 20, 30, 40 years ago are coming back to sort of haunt us and that it's gonna take us some time to get out of that. I think that is where it can feel frustrating sometimes is you see measures being passed with additional funding, things like that, that it feels like you should be able to tangibly see a change or an improvement quite quickly. These are not sort of challenges that can happen that quickly. And we really dug ourselves a hole over decades of time. So I appreciate you pointing out sort of the longevity and the longer arc of some of this to lead us to where we are. Just an incredibly succinct way of doing that very quickly, Ryan. So
I've never been praised for being succinct before, so I'll take it.
Comprehensive and precise. So I appreciate that. These are really complex things. And I think I appreciate sort of all the pieces you touched on there. So moving on just a little bit, because I know it's a short time to be together today. I want to just spend some time sort of talking with the rest of the panelists a little bit on, given the sort of direct service work and the things you've seen, really trying to understand where you're seeing things that are working and where we are seeing opportunity and potential traction. And so maybe starting with you, Carielle, like given your long history in the direct service space, what are you seeing that has changed about where people need to get and stay housed sort of in the Bay Area? And what interventions to homelessness are you seeing that are sort of most effective for your clients right now?
It's a good question. I think we've always seen a range of participants in our programs who some people come to homelessness through one catastrophic event. Someone dies, someone loses a job, there's a medical emergency, and they need a very short intervention to get back on their feet. And that's at one end of the range. The other end of the range is folks who are, as Ryan was describing, have experienced generations of homelessness, generations of poverty, generations of poor educational outcomes, generations of poor health, generations of substance use, generations of domestic violence. It's going to take a lot longer to get that family back on track. And somewhere along that range is everybody else, right? And then what we're seeing now, I think that's very, very different, is the influx of newcomers to the country. We've been talking about this for the last, it feels very sudden, but it's been going on for almost a year, I guess, that we've been seeing folks come from, you know, parts of Latin America that we've never seen come to this country in such volume. We're seeing folks come from Ukraine. We're seeing folks come from Yemen and Turkey. And that feels very new. And they're coming to the country with no knowledge of the country, no knowledge of the language, no knowledge of the systems, knowledge of the benefits that they're entitled to. And so the process of getting them into some kind of, you know, program that can support them is a lot more burdensome. So it takes a lot more work, it takes a lot more time, it takes a lot more money. And that part is very, very new. In my own staff, we have an emergency shelter and we have a transitional housing program. The emergency shelter, I checked with our shelter director this morning. She said 90% of our residents at this moment are newcomers to the country.
Wow.
Which is a brand new thing for us. And we have the biggest shelter in the city for families. And there are only so many bilingual case managers. I mean, there just aren't enough. And so that feels new. And the other part of it that feels new is that the newcomers are bringing regional conflicts with them. Mm-hmm. And so we have, in our shelter, we have congregate settings and some private settings. In the congregate settings, we might have a family from Colombia and a family from Venezuela. And those two countries' populations don't really interact well. And so there's friction and drama. And all of a sudden, we have to undo that placement and replace those families in other places. And so it makes it much more complicated.
Yeah.
And I think in addition to that, the other thing that we're seeing that's different is there's a level of acuity of need that's a lot higher. People, it feels like people are coming, families are coming to us with more barriers, more burdens, more trauma, more domestic violence, more community violence that they've experienced. And, you know, it just seems like it requires a lot more to get folks back to where we want them to be. For example, our model was initially supposed to be sort of a light touch case management model. You know, we help families briefly, we help them set goals, help them get back on track, help them find a job, and move them on into housing, provide a rental subsidy for a couple of years, and then off they go. That is not the case for most of the families that we're seeing now. That formula, that is not quite as easy. They're requiring much deeper levels of case management because we're addressing deeper levels of trauma and generational. I think generational problems are really, I think, the harder issues for folks who are native to San Francisco. So it's more challenging now than it ever has been, I think, as a result of, you know, decades of, you know, underinvestment in housing and homelessness services, you know, since the 80s, I would imagine, if not even earlier than that.
But yeah. Can I ask you where you're seeing opportunities?
Ah.
Interventions that might be working despite what you just mentioned? Are there any?
There are some. there are some that are working. The one that comes most to mind is the Guaranteed Basic Income Program. Mm-hmm. They've been popping up all over the country over the last couple of years. And, you know, in some ways it's like easy math. Low-income folks, give them money, it'll change their circumstance. Imagine that. But it does actually work, right? You know, it's really not hard. But you know, it's an idea that's coming to fruition in a lot of places. For example, we just launched our own version of a Guaranteed Basic Income Program. And just in November, and already we're seeing families seeing benefits from it already. And so I think that's one of the ways that the interventions that actually work. Cash transfers is one. The other that we're seeing work is really intensive workforce development training, really helping people not think about getting a job, but think about building a career that will as a viable for your family over time. Helping families to think less about making money and more about building wealth, so that they can leave something behind for their family, for their kids, so that 10 years, your kids are not in the queue and a homeless services organization having the same problems that you're experiencing now. And some of that is about helping families think about their futures in a very different way than their present is. Mm. And that future orientation is really necessary because most folks are in the grind. They're thinking about today, this month, I got to pay rent, I got to buy food, I got to pay, you know, I got a flat tire. And they don't have the leisure to sort of think about, in a decade, where do I want to be? Where do I want my family to be? Where do I want my kids to be? And so we're trying to get people to make that sort of, it's a subtle but really important mental shift around future orientation instead of present orientation. Your future can be very different than your present if you want it to be so. And that's where we're trying to, that's one of the ways that we're trying to help families get into that space. So those things are working.
Yeah. Well, and that's actually a really nice transition to Robin, actually, because I know you have spent a lot of your career thinking about workforce development and sort of career and training skills. So how are you seeing that piece play into how we're serving and helping folks get out of homelessness?
Absolutely. I think the the concept of dreaming is not one that we often consider to be a viable idea for people to be successful. To your point, if you're always concerned with the immediacy of your need, right? My family is hungry, my tire isn't fixed, and I have to get to work, and I can't miss my job one more time, then you really don't have the flexibility emotionally or psychologically to think future forward. And if you think about the people who have wealth and have been able to maintain wealth in the United States, these are people who were investing, right? Like saving those pennies and putting them in to, you know, little known companies like Apple or Microsoft when they weren't valuable at all. But then 30, 40, 50 years later, their families never have to work again because they were able to make that level of investment in their future. So the same thing really needs to happen for workforce development. Oftentimes programs are designed to be able to stand a family up, right? Like, let me get your car fixed this one time. Let's get you in an interview. Let's put you in some interview clothes and get you off, and we'll see you through your 90-day period where you're assured now that you've got a little more flexibility, or now your benefits start, and then you take your hands off and walk away. But really what is the reality is that those families run into lots of social emotional problems at work at 6 months, at 9 months, at a year, and they don't have any thought partners or help to be able to help them remediate those issues. So thinking about developing programs that are designed with wraparound services that are a longer on-ramp to the off-ramp, and then that off-ramp also being really long. And that level of investment, it doesn't show success in 6 months. It doesn't show success in a year. And that makes some people feel uncomfortable. Well, how do we know if it's working? Well, it's working because in 10 years, their children won't be standing at your door looking for the same type of services. So it also requires a fairly high amount of long-term investment around data evaluation and tracking. So the true answer to that question is take some time, build a strong program, get a mix of partnerships so that when one falls off, because they often do, you're not standing up and pulling down programs that folks are reliant on, and that you have the opportunity to be a true support to people who have been traumatized by systems for generations.
Yeah, thank you. And then Kevin, switching to you, I mean, I think Miracle Messages is a unique sort of service or role in the midst of all of this. So we'd love to just sort of hear, how are you seeing that play out, and sort of what surprised you as you've gotten going?
Yeah, absolutely. Even listening to the first, 15, 20 minutes of this panel, you can't help but be struck that homelessness is perhaps the most intersectional issue of our time. When you think about all the systems that are broken in our society, housing, criminal justice, workforce development, mental behavioral health systems, discrimination, racism, at some level, all roads can lead to homelessness. But what I found, and the what I share in my book, and really center to our work at Miracle Messages, is that there's this other set of systems going on, and that's the systems between people, the interpersonal systems, how we regard one another. When we see people experiencing homelessness as problems to be solved, not as people to be loved, that's a problem. We've narrowed our humanity in narrowing their humanity. As a quick aside, I wanted to just share. So today is actually like the worst day of the year for me every year, because this is the day my mom passed away. She passed away 16 years ago. And when she died, I was 23 years old. And I took a leave of absence. I was in grad school at the time. This is like round two or three. I forget the number on that. And I basically had to move back into my childhood home and get it ready for rental. Now, I was sleeping on a mattress in an abandoned house, getting it ready for rental. But I had, at that time, keys to three or four friends and neighbors' houses and people I could crash with, check in on me. And I had family to support me to get by. And I got through that period. A week ago, I was in Minnesota, and I met a person who's not that younger than me. He's about the same age, in his 30s, named Devin. He's a Native American a man. And incidentally, March 21st, 2005 is his worst day. So that was the day that both of his parents were murdered in the first of what became called the Red Lake shootings on the reservation that he lived on. It was his nephew, got the gun, shot both of his parents, went on a shooting spree, and then killed himself. He was 13 years old at the time. And at that point, he moved in with his grandma. His grandma at the time lived in a two-bedroom apartment. 16 other people in that two-bedroom apartment. And that's one little aside here. We talk about homelessness. We also talk about like prevention and about how this could be a lot worse before it gets a lot better. And 8 or 9 years after his grandma took him in, she passed away. And he's been on the streets ever since. Now, on the surface, if you didn't know his story, you'd see that he's been in and out of prison. There's some drug offenses. You talk about the incarceration thing. But really, it goes back to some of the relationships, the strength of those relationships, intergenerational poverty, and what kinds of supports that he has. So the work at Miracle Messages is really centered on this angle of the relational aspects of homelessness and what we can all do as individuals. So we help people who are experiencing homelessness rebuild their social support systems and financial security. We do family and friend reunification services, where we've reunited about 1,000 people with their loved ones, recording messages and then delivering them through a network of digital detectives. But we also know for some people, family's part of the problem, not part of the solution. There's reasons why people are disconnected. There's resources that aren't available. And that's where we created our second program, which is called our Miracle Friends Phone Buddy Program, where we match everyday individuals as volunteers, one-to-one, to have weekly phone calls and text messages, kind of like a Big Brother, Big Sisters program for unhoused neighbors, but really trying to be on somewhat equal footing as friends, as neighbors. And then through that program and the relationships and the trust that was built, we started hearing from our volunteers. And pretty consistently they said, you know, you've asked me to be friends with this person. It's very hard to be friends if they don't know what they're gonna do for dinner tonight, or if they don't know how they're gonna get gas in their car to get back to work on Monday. So that's what led us in December 2020 to create what turned out to be one of the first basic income pilots for individuals experiencing homelessness in the country. We raised $50,000. We selected 14 individuals from the 60 that were nominated by their volunteer friends. $500 a month for 6 months, no strings attached. I was skeptical. I wasn't sure, I mean, how the money would be used, but more like it's $500. What difference is that going to make in a Bay Area rental market? And we found after 6 months, 2/3 of those individuals secured housing. They used the money better than I could have used it for them. And so now we're doing, as part of probably some of the same Google.org funded work that Hamilton Families is doing, a $2.1 million randomized control trial where we're giving out $750 a month for 12 months. To over 100 unhoused individuals in Oakland, San Francisco, and in Los Angeles County. The early quick results, this hasn't been public yet, but I'll share as a little sneak preview. The rate of unsheltered homelessness has declined 60% in the treatment group compared to the control group. I think it was about 30% in the treatment group to start with unsheltered. Went down to 12% after 6 months of $750 a month. And then one stat that we just found is that the actual amount of homelessness has reduced by half in the treatment group compared to in the control group. So very promising, I agree, the direct cash, but I would also just center that we're probably looking for like silver bullets around this. There's no silver bullet. You have 100 people experiencing homelessness. You have 100 stories, context, situations. I think part of what's required is for us to do what Brian Stevenson talks about of getting proximate, or I would say getting relational. And if you care about the issue of homelessness, being able to say you know an unhoused neighbor as a friend or as a neighbor.
And I do like, though, the thread that's sort of coming through on a lot of this of sort of addition, like more cash, workforce, sort of understanding this as sort of a financial security issue more so than some of these other pieces that I think we're often hearing. So talking a little bit and sort of moving up to a bigger system, sort of as a former government leader myself, I have to, and sort of given that this is a Goldman School of Public Policy event, I have to bring up government and sort of their role in this crisis and their role in helping us get out of it. I think it goes without saying that the funding that they are providing scales out as now I'm in philanthropy, way scales out anything that we are able to put in. And absent them actually figuring out how to use that money efficiently and effectively, we will not get ourselves out of this crisis. So I want to start sort of just with Ryan, and sort of given some of the recent research that you have been working on, would love to just sort of hear, especially the statewide analysis on homelessness services, but where are you seeing government support being effective, and where are you seeing it be sort of, there needs to be more, it needs to be different, it needs to sort of expand?
Yeah. So I think over the past 2 years, we've been doing a series of different kinds of studies looking at various elements of how the state government, federal government, local governments are expanding homelessness services and programs and housing. And I think one of the big benefits of recent investments in homelessness has been around the urgency, the scale, and then the flexibility for innovation. So I think programs like HomeKey, which provides localities capital to purchase and convert properties like hotels and motels into supportive housing, like they're hard, but they, like we heard from HomeKey operators across the state, like they've never seen housing produced this quickly. Yeah. And so that's a kind of innovation that previous public investments haven't really provided for. But even just flexible block grant funding for things that federal funding for homelessness haven't traditionally provided. So things like safe parking programs have been really hard to fund with the typical federal homelessness assistance money. But state funds that were much more flexible from what used to be the Homeless Coordinating and Financing Council. I'm not sure if you're familiar.
Am I a little? Yeah.
Yeah, are you okay?
I helped rename it because it's a terrible name.
Yeah, the rebranding helped, I think, actually a lot. at least how many times I've had to type it. But that kind of innovation, it allowed for people to develop new models that served people better than the pre-existing boxes that were prescribed by federal funding. And what could work better is just more sustained, predictable resources of that type. So what we heard from practitioners across the state in our research is that these resources helped to do something new and exciting and meet a need that is either new or that they hadn't been able to address before, but that the money's going to run out because they got a single pot of money to draw on. And it's hard to make a sustained investment in a program, in training people, in building relationships with program participants when you don't know if that money is going to be there for this program next year. Yep. And I think that's the single biggest need for making the public money more effective than it's been.
Yeah. Great. I'm getting a slew of really good questions over here, but before I dive into these, for other folks on the panel, anybody else that would sort of like to chime in and think through sort of where have you seen government funding or government support being useful? I'm kind of looking to you, but yeah. Anyone on the panel that would like to add in or add to that?
Yeah, I'll chime in for a second. Government funding is absolutely vital. I mean, there's no way that private philanthropy will ever match what the government can provide. So they have to be part of the solution. Having said that, government bureaucracies are hard to move.
Yes.
They're like, they move at the glacial pace and innovation is hard. You know, it's very difficult to use those funds quickly and in new ways. And so I think to Ryan's point, innovation is key, speed is key. And I feel like a certain level of trust in providers is also necessary. People who are embedded in the communities, know the communities, know what they need, fund them and get out of their way.
Yeah.
But let them do what they know is best in the communities that they're working in. And I feel like that there's been a level of mistrust in the nonprofit sector around, you know, how government views us, not as partners, but maybe as grantees. And that's not the same thing. I think we need to be partners in a more robust way. And there needs to be a level of trust that we actually do know what we're doing, and we are listening to the communities that we're working in, and we will use those funds in the best way possible. That would be super helpful.
Yeah, and I would say that both government and, unfortunately, the San Francisco Chronicle is not helping you with that message recently on nonprofit so providers and understanding how hard and important the work you all do. So I will just, I'd be remiss to not show a little frustration at how they have been not adding fuel to that fire in, I think, a really unhelpful way. You're doing great work.
Thank you.
Others on the table that would want to engage.
I'll echo a few things and perhaps bring up a slightly controversial point, which
I love it. Bring it.
It's time for some excitement.
Spice it up for you, Robin. Come on.
I think the point is well made that government rarely treats grantees as partners. I think it was Ryan that first brought racism into the conversation, so I feel very confident based on your skills that I can jump on that the back of that monkey and say it is largely nonprofit organizations run by Black, Indigenous, and people of color who are doing the good work. And those are the organizations that have not been afforded the opportunity to build their infrastructure to be able to even qualify for some of those programs. And they are doing the work, but can't afford audited actuals and don't have a CFO. And so therefore are not even in proximity to be able to be in receipt of funds that could help do the work that they're already doing on a daily basis. But in addition to that, the amount of understanding that someone has of what is required to truly accomplish the task who works in the system is rarely the reality of the person who is actually doing the work. And so those folks need to be in conversation even when those RFPs are being developed.
Yep.
So that there's a greater understanding of it will take X number of months or it will cost X number of dollars. Many times, I have been a executive director of a nonprofit organization for years, and so many times you choose between program or staff, and especially post-pandemic, we are very clear about the fact that if we are not caring for the staff who are caring for our program participants, that is a failed level of investment because you're just burning everyone out.
Yep.
So the reality is it costs twice as much as most grants actually provide an organization to be able to do the work well.
Yeah.
So then everybody is doing the work as well as they can.
Yeah.
And that is then when they get judged.
Yep.
And that's the uncomfortable truth.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would mention, I mean, one of the things that coming from switching from government to philanthropy that I have found really enjoyable, I will say, and understanding sort of how do different sectors play in. What is the role of a nonprofit organization in solving this crisis? What is the role of government in solving this crisis? And what is the role of philanthropy in solving this crisis? I do think there are unique, important roles for each, but they're not necessarily coordinated and talking together, right? So philanthropy right now, at Tipping Point, we're in the midst of talking and supporting those sort of younger or under-resourced nonprofits right now, and helping them build their capacity so that they do have more of a chance to apply for funding down the road. That feels like a really sweet spot for philanthropy, right? So that then they're ready, they can't be as risk tolerant as philanthropy can, so then they come in and do that. But it's really trying to better understand how do each of the pieces of the puzzle play together. So I appreciate all of the points you're making. Kevin, anything you wanna say before I dive in on?
I'm interested in the questions just briefly. You know, I've been surprised, I echo what you're saying. The RFP process, it's rigid and it's predetermines what things need to look like. It doesn't actually fit. We're experiencing that right now. So that's a cool scene by you. I think one challenge that I've seen at a local level in San Francisco, where I've mostly been based for the last 10 years, is there was a very, in my experience, black and white view when it came to housing. It was either permanent supportive housing or shelters. And this has shifted, I think, in the last 10 years. But you know, programs of tiny homes, interim housing, safe parking, things of that sort. I found that there was a real rigidity in what kind of approaches we're willing to invest in. And I tend to believe in a kind of yes and approach to housing, right? Do we need more housing of this type? Yes. Do we need more of this? Yes. We're just underfunded. I mean, 7.5 million units short to meet current demand nationwide. So I feel like that's starting to shift, and I've been grateful for that. But that yes and thinking, I think, has not always been characteristic of government, at least at a local level. I also just bring it back to some of the importance of investing, whether it's child tax credit or other funds that reach folks upstream before they become homeless. Mm-hmm. I mean, we ask this question, why are so many people experiencing homelessness? That's a really important question. Equally important question that doesn't get asked. One out of every two Americans are a paycheck away from not paying rent. 47% of people say they don't know where they'd get $400 for an unexpected emergency. So you almost have to ask this question, why aren't more people experiencing homelessness? And what we're finding is family, friends, community, church, synagogue, mosque, informal economy, relationships, social capital is making up the difference. As one unhoused neighbor put it to me, I'll never forget, I never realized I was homeless when I lost my housing, only when I lost my family and friends.
Mm.
So I just think we have to look at the relational structures, like Devin being doubled up, 16 dubbed, I don't even know what the word is, to make sure that we do as much as we can to support those families' relationships so folks don't fall over into homelessness.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and if we have time, I want to dig in on prevention, but I want to get to these questions here for a second, because I've been scribbling and I've been seeing that thread playing out here too, but we're trying our hardest to get through a whole good slew of a conversation here. So I'm going to sort of bucket a couple of these together. So there's a couple of questions that are very interested in thoughts on Prop 1. Mm-hmm. Moderator prerogative. I'm also going to ask a little bit about like upcoming affordable housing ballot measures that are coming down the pike in November that are also critically important and also something that folks in the room should be mentioned and thinking about. Anybody want to chime in on sort of now that Prop 1 looks real, how to think about that, how to prioritize and think about that funding. And if not, if that feels like a thing you don't want to dive in on, also for an entire group of, I hope, California voters, things that they should be thinking about for the November ballot, because there's some really interesting things happening there too that I'd be remiss in not mentioning.
I'll be the sacrificial lamb. So I was pretty strongly in support of Prop 1. And my views on a lot of this has been influenced heavily by the loved ones of people experiencing homelessness. So when talking to families who have loved ones on the streets, my uncle was homeless for 30 years, lived on the streets of Santa Cruz. There's no quality of life of that loved one living and dying on the streets. Mm-hmm. Dr. Katie Coe from out of Harvard, she recently talked about the importance of the role of involuntary holds in treatment. Okay, now there's plenty of asterisks to that we have to talk about, I believe, which is first, have you done everything possible before you get to that point? Explain housing options, are they a threat to themselves or to others? And then if there is an involuntary hold or treatment, which again, my views on have been informed by the families who have advocated for it, what happens next, right? The rub is, do people then get discharged to the streets? We can't get back to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest institutions. So what kind of housing transitions, recovery programs exist? So I think it is important that we're moving in the direction to have more mental health treatment investments. I was very much opposed to Prop F in San Francisco, because I think there was, it's kind of an unfunded mandate, and it really plays into the paternalism that's so common around the space around homelessness. But Prop 1 I was in favor of because of the combination of money going in, as well as this is actually kind of the investments that will try to move us forward. Is it perfect? No, but I think it's a step in the right direction.
So. Yeah. Anybody on Prop 1 or on future ballot measures people should be interested in November?
I have a favorite ballot measure that I like to talk about. So the Bay Area Housing Finance Agency has a ballot measure for affordable housing development. And I think we
on the November.
We see a lot of really promising interventions, housing projects that are like helping people move back inside and stay housed and supported, or helping people like avoid ever entering homelessness in the first place all around the Bay Area. And they are pulling together as many pieces of the puzzle as they can. And it's a ton of work and it's really hard to put together all the money needed to develop affordable housing in the Bay Area. And this just puts a lot more pieces of that puzzle within reach to really scale up efforts that are working and making a difference for a lot of people every day.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.